This is a production of Cornell University.
I'm calling the meeting to order. We'll start with roll call of the voting members. Arts and Humanities, Kristen.
Here.
Jesse. Becca.
Here.
Life Sciences, Tyler.
Here.
Elena?
Here.
Cassandra?
Here.
Physical Sciences and Engineering, Ariana?
Here.
Sarah?
Here.
Alex?
Here.
Zenda? Present via Zoom. Professional Schools, Alexei?
Absent.
Gabrielle?
Here.
Cheyenne? Absent. Social Sciences, Margaret?
Here.
Cara Rose?
Here.
Wendy?
Here.
Next on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Any changes?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
Is there any dissent to approving the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes is approved. And next on the agenda, we have a presentation by Samantha Adams from Maplewood.
Hi, everybody. It's been a long time since I've been in a lecture hall. Hi. So once we get the slides up, we're going to give a little bit of an update on the Maplewood Apartments. I'm the community manager there. I've been with Maplewood since about September and EDR overall for about 5 years now. Hopefully, the next slide will have an overview of the property. So previously I was supposed to have a picture of our kind of layout. I don't know where it went, but it was there. So if you go to the next page. So I thought it might be interesting for folks to know kind of the popularity of the different bedroom types. So this is a layout. The top is the most popular. The bottom is the least popular so far. So we're about halfway sold out of our one bedrooms and kind of on the way down. So studio is the one most popular. Probably not a huge surprise there. So I thought that might be interesting to folks. Right, the next slide. So this is kind of the construction progress so far. I don't know if people get down Mitchell Street much, so you probably don't see most of what we're doing if you're just seeing Maple. So this is the entrance to Mitchell, and I will also say these are from 2 weeks ago, so we are a little bit further along than what's in here. So that's the entrance on Mitchell. This is Building B. It's one of the apartment buildings, one kind of along Mitchell Street. And then Building C. And I know we've gotten a lot of questions about, like, am I going to have sunlight in my apartment? So as you can see, they're pretty big windows, so there should be nice and sunny in there for everybody. Building D. This is the one that's kind of like in the middle of the property. This is the one you can see from Maple. And then the next two, E and F, these ones are the least far along in everything in the property. These are the ones that are on Maple. So if you're just seeing Maple and you're like, oh my gosh, nothing's happening, these ones are going to be the last ones done, but they are scheduled to be open on August 20th for moving. The rest of the property is much further along. Actually, here's after starting to do some of the framing work. All right, and then so these are some of the townhouses that are on Mitchell Street. Let me go to the next slide. So these are what we call the pitched roof townhouses. They're in a variety of colors. They're the ones that kind of feel like a more traditional, like, multifamily kind of townhouse. And then the next slide, we also have our brick townhouses. So those are starting to come along as well. So floor plans, so I don't know if folks have looked at our website, but if not, I thought I would share some of the floor plans. They're cut up a little bit, but just kind of get the idea. So this is the studio layout, and we've got a couple of different styles of those. And then we've got the one bedrooms, and then these have been the most popular units that we've had going so far. Then we've got two types of two bedrooms within the apartments. And then we've got the three bedrooms. And then that's kind of it for the apartments. And then into the townhouses, we actually have two-bedroom flats. So this is, so this stairwell is actually an exterior stair. That goes to the townhouses above it. So this is a one-floor townhouse apartment, call it a flat. And then above that, I'm going to go to the next one, we have these townhouses. There's two stacked on top of each flat. So this would be the second floor and the third floor, but it's its own contained apartment. And then they get a little bit wonky on the sides. These are actually, so this is a three-bedroom townhouse, so for a second, third floor. And that third floor is actually a little bit shorter on top because there's just the one-bedroom. And then we also have a three-bedroom townhouse with a garage. So you see the first floor has the garage entrance here with a bedroom. And then there's just kind of a hill. So then there's also an entrance into the second floor, which is the common area. And then the third floor would be aligned appropriately. There just wasn't quite room on the slide. And then finally, we've got the four-bedroom townhouses. Same kind of idea, except a full-size top floor with two bedrooms on it. You'll notice when you're going through those, every apartment has its own washer and dryer. Every bedroom has its own bathroom. And we've got some common spaces. These came out a little bit weird. But so this will be in the community center. There's a big kind of open space. And then there's going to be a fitness center also in the community center that will be open 24/7. And then the last little bit here. We are going to have a community garden. And then these study rooms, I think, are actually the study rooms that will be in each of the apartment buildings, and there's two on every floor. So one's more of a hangout space, and one's got more of desks in it. All right, also just as an FYI, we do have some student employment opportunities. Some is available as early as right now. So we're currently hiring some marketing outreach assistants. These don't have to be a future resident in Maplewood. It's preferred, but not required. Basically, you help out around the office, giving tours, and just making sure people know that we exist and that we're going to be an option. And then we're looking for people to start now, and then also people who are going to be around for the summer. And then in the fall, we'll have GCAs, at least six. And the way that works, sort of similar to a kind of a combination of like a desk assistant and like an RA that you would have seen in undergrad. So it's a mixture of programming, helping us out with the community center, so we can help us with packages and tours and that sort of thing. The compensation for that is you get 20% discount on rent plus an hourly wage for all of the hours that you work with programming and things. Ideally, we're looking for about 14 hours per week, but we know some grad students have restrictions on how many hours they work. So if we have a lot of applicants with low hour availability, we'll hire more to kind of balance out our hour needs. And for that, we do have to be an Maplewood resident to be eligible, since you will have an on-call shift, like if there's walkouts and those sort of things. All right, and then on the note of programming, we've got this question a lot from more so staff at Cornell that asked this so far, and then some of the students who come for focus groups. So these are some of the ideas we have, but it's really going to be tailored to what our residents want us to do. So everything from, you know, fun programs, so there's free food you just come and get before you go to class, to inviting faculty for presentations, doing stress relief. We've done free chair massages at other properties, bringing in therapy animals on those high stress times of year, new potlucks, doing designated dissertation writing times that don't conflict with the Big Red Barn, because we want to be good partners with them. So those are some of the things. We will have a community kitchen in the center as well, so we can do cooking classes and those sort of things. But again, this will really tailor to what the residents actually want to do. And then these are just some of the frequently asked questions we get. We'll be opening on August 20th. We are on schedule for that opening. And we know it's kind of a rough opening day since classes start so soon after, and some programs actually start before that. Unfortunately, with the way construction works, that's as early as we can open, but we will be adjusting that for future years to be more accessible based on program start times. You'll know a lot of students now who they want to live in the bigger apartments, but they don't have roommates. That's totally fine. We lease by each bed separately. We have like an app called RoomSafe that we'll be launching. And that's kind of like online dating, except for roommates. So that's really coming very soon. We are pet friendly. It's one pet per person with a max of two pets per apartment, so cats and dogs are allowed. We do have some 10-month leases, so if somebody is graduating next May and they don't want to worry about settling their summer out, we do have some of those available. And then we also get the question on security deposit. There's two options for that. You can either pay the refundable security deposit, or if you have somebody, typically a parent or guardian doesn't have to be 25 plus U.S. social, and they pass their credit check, they can co-sign instead of paying the deposit, so it's one or the other. So those are some of the most common things we get asked. I know that was really quick. I know you guys have a lot of stuff to talk about today, so I didn't want to take too much of your time, but any questions?
So I'm taking questions. I have Matt.
First off, thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah.
I have two questions. One's really easy. If someone has questions, do you have a contact email or some way to get in touch with you?
Absolutely. So if you email Ithaca@edrtrust.com, that'll go to our entire office.
Thank you so much. And the other question was, in terms of graduate students and also professional students, I know eventually the dissertation writing hours and perhaps fortunately I don't have to write dissertation in general, a lot of law students.
Yep.
I'm curious, are you looking at how to accommodate professional students, for instance, out of the law school, our exams are 2 weeks before everyone else, and you have exams all the time you're here. Just to be aware of that, how we do accommodate that based on the resident base.
That is something that partially we're hoping that our GCEs can help us know when those times are, and we'll accommodate as best we can. So if we know that we have a huge law student population, we know they're examining 2 weeks before everybody else is, we'll try to make sure we have a good program for both those weeks.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. All right, Nisha?
So I have sort of a few questions. What percent of the total number of beds you have available has already been filled?
Just about 15%.
Okay. And sort of like a tab onto that, what is the strategy to reach new students? So as programs are now accepting and admitting students, what's the strategy that you guys are deploying to get in contact with them?
Yeah, so we're doing a number of things. So it depends a little bit on the program. So for example, for like the law school, we're going to be at some of their accepted students. I think it's Fridays they have events. I know the vet school, they had our flyers out when they were having their events. I worked with Jenna at the grad school to put information in some of the acceptance letters that they send out. So we're trying to, and then they're also in some kind of grad school, I think, forget who sent it out, but it's like a housing guide for new students. So we're trying to get to them both when they're coming to campus and also the stuff that goes out to them as well.
Thank you.
I want to take a moment to appreciate the fact that I've been involved in Maplewood projects since the start, and you've taken into consideration a lot of concerns and comments that you had from the student community and incorporated that into your final plan. And I really want to appreciate the effort you've taken to that end. My question goes towards, I have a two-part question. The 40 hours annual hourly pay for GCAs, I'm trying to compare that with the earlier system that existed where we had four GCAs whose rent was fully covered in addition to bus staff and gym and such. And trying to see how this model compensates GCAs as compared to them. So what is the hourly wage you're looking at? Does that cover rent?
Yeah, so the way we're looking at it is that if a student is in a three-bedroom apartment and they do the 14 hours, the wage would cover the rest of the rent, so they should end up with roughly three rent.
I do want to point out to you that, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, I'm not passing comment about it, but matter of fact, the GCAs used to get an entire two-bedroom apartment to themselves in the previous model. Of course, there were four GCAs and not six. Mm-hmm. And I want to point out to you that there is therefore a difference. Again, I don't know how many hours of work they put in because I don't know how that. The second question I have for you is with regard to the deposit.
Yep.
On the board, on the signature. A significant population of Maplewood residents used to be international students.
Mm-hmm.
And as an international student, I can tell you that trying to read a lease agreement from halfway around the world is very challenging because I don't know what that means and I'm scared of the law and I don't know what the legal terms that are involved in the lease.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I signed up with Maplewood because I said, well, I'm signing up with Cornell. There's no deposit. I don't have dollars back from India to pay a deposit. And I was fortunate that most people don't have a guarantor to sign on their behalf. So that's a long question to you. How does this model support international students who are unable to pay a deposit or have guarantors, which may be a large population of people that
I will say that I would think probably at this point about 80% of our students are doing the deposit option. Partially, I think, is
you know, the age of graduating, they will not ask their parents to be guarantor, so even some of the domestic students are really ahead of paying that. As for the folks who don't have access to American money yet to be able to pay, that's something we still have to look into. Because typically the U.S. have one or the other, but I'll definitely, I can look into that for sure.
And you're in the unique position that the entire degree of the student, the purpose of their coming to Cornell, lies in the hands of Cornell,
mm-hmm.
and you, to an agreement with Cornell, have some control over that. The student not leave without paying or without paying for damage to an apartment, then perhaps you can explore that with Cornell.
Thank you.
So part of my question was answered regarding the way that you just asked that. So if without, even with a 20% discount on rent, the Maplewood apartments are substantially more expensive than comparable housing, say, downtown. And graduate students looking at something like a position for the summer, many of the people who look at those positions probably are doing so because they don't have the support or any support over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And the schools offering those students like a job, right, that is 20 hours a week, which is what a graduate RA-ship or TA-ship also expects, that pays substantially less than that, so it's pretty problematic. Is there a plan to, at some point, raise the wages so that they both cover rent and the rest of the graduate life? Do you have any comparable stipend?
I don't know, but I can look into that. So, I am saying that the rates at Maplewood are more expensive than ones like downtown as far as housing.
From what I remember from the presentation, which had the rent rates, yes, substantially more expensive. You can get, you know, four people, you can easily find very nice housing downtown for around $500 each.
Okay. Well, I can say that we did set the rates with Cornell, and it was with the intention of it being a more affordable option than, for example, like a college on terrace, which is, you know, $200-$400 more per month for like the studios and one bedroom. So I think I have heard that it is more expensive because I thought the kind of when we were working with Cornell, the purpose was for it to be more affordable. So I heard that, so I'll definitely look into that. I don't know yet what the plan is as far as like raising the rate of the wages for the GCAs, but I think I can ask to management, but that's right now that's kind of where it's at, is it's going to be comparable to free housing.
So we have quite a few students with families, like spouses and partners, and I was wondering what the price is for families and how you take into account like the number of people. Is it just per bed? So you put all three of your kids in one bed, it's still one bed, or is it, how are you handling like student families?
Yeah, so we have noticed that a lot of the families are finding it less affordable than, for example, Hasbrook. We do rent by the bed, and we do have some occupancy guidelines. So, for example, one bedroom can accommodate either one individual, a couple, or a couple with an infant under 6 months old,
mm-hmm.
which is the fair housing laws, is how that's determined. So beyond that, we just follow fair housing laws as far as how many people can be in a bedroom. And I believe with children, I think if they are allowed to do two per bed, but we, since we haven't had that question yet, I haven't looked into it to the specific details about exactly how that works.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we get that question a lot, and we actually do what's called a term lease rather than a monthly rent lease. So the way that works, and we have had that question a lot. So the way that works is we figure out the rent from August 20th through July 31st and then divide it by 12 so that it's always the same payment, so that we don't have to worry about having a separate payment for August and then a higher payment for all the other months.
Oh, yes, one last question.
This was a question I think that came up earlier, but is Maplewood count at Cornell University? Because I know that international students, you can't work if it's not a university campus. And the second part of that is, with the hourly system that I think you just switched to, international students can work more than a certain number of hours, as opposed to saying, if rent is covered, then that would be separate from the TA trip that they would have to have in 24 hours.
Yeah, so we are kind of a weird situation where we are not considered on-campus housing, but Cornell does own the land. So we do work closely with Cornell on a lot of our policies. For example, as mentioned earlier, they actually set the rent, and their board had to approve the rent. As far as international students with the position, unfortunately, because of off-campus housing, as you said, you do have to be able to work in the U.S. to be able to work with us. I know that there was some talk with Cornell. I don't know the update yet, but I know there has been some discussions with Cornell about another way to help facilitate that. I just haven't gotten the update yet.
Yeah, so Manisha can...
Yeah, so we've had a series of meetings with not only Dean Vijay, Dean Pentecor, and
Jeremy
Thomas, and he's not going to be our real estate for Cornell. And so they are aware of the problem, and I think they were meeting either tomorrow or late last week or tomorrow to talk about this. They are trying to find a solution, but it's a complicated situation. But they have been made aware of the problem, and they would like to find a resolution for the problem.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. And if anybody has other questions, as I said, you're welcome to email us. Our contact information is on our website. It's also Ithaca@NDRTrust.com.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda item is GPSA structure discussion led by Alex.
Hi, everyone. So today we're going to have a discussion that it's been a long time in the making, and that is whether the way the GPSA is set up right now is serving our interests as a community, and in terms of the fields and organizations that send people to us, are they getting participation and advocacy out of it, ultimately? So as a quick reminder, all of this is also covered in the appendix document that was in the meeting packet today, but for those of us who prefer a more auditory mechanism than this, I have it here. So we have a whole bunch of different fields and field organizations that, for example, like my field is biomedical engineering, and then the field organization would be Biomedical Engineering Society, and then they send each field will send field representatives to the assembly, one for each field, and you get more representatives if you have a whole bunch of students, and then also the professional schools will each send a representative. And so these field representatives, they attend the meetings so that their fields can get money. They can, they go back to the fields to talk about what we talk about at GPSA. Yes, Elena?
Point of privilege, can you turn the lights above the screen on?
Thank you. So field representatives, they attend meetings so they can get funding. They talk with their fields, ideally, about what happened with GPSA. They can speak on the floor, they can sponsor resolutions, but they can't vote on motions on the floor. But they can elect voting members, officers, and chairs. And then what happens is we group together these fields based on discipline. So like there's biological sciences, humanities, or physical sciences, social sciences, and professional schools. And that's what we call our division or caucus. And then each division will elect its own slate of voting members. And then one voting member will serve as the division chief, who kind of coordinates the communications between the leadership and the committees and then the field representatives. So ideally, we have a unified message going out. So in our diagram, that's part of voting members, which come from these field groups. And voting members, we expect them to be the most informed members, kind of the leadership in the GPSA. And they get priority when it comes to officer or chair positions, but there's nothing explicitly saying that they have to take one of these positions. They get same speaking and sponsoring privileges as before. They can vote on resolutions, and their attendance is what we do the roll call for to make sure that we have enough people so that we can actually do something in the meetings. And then from there, everything is under the discretion of the exec committee, specifically the executive vice president is who kind of oversees these internal structure. then where it starts getting nebulous is where we have these tier 3 and 4 organizations. So the Finance Commission guidelines, which we worked hard on last year, they define these different tiers of funding. And we said that if you're a tier 3 or 4, you have to send someone to your GPSA to get your money. So they are asking for a lot of money and or they have a lot of people. And what you often find is that these are representing like identity or interest groups that aren't necessarily well represented within the assembly. And right now, they don't have voting membership directly. It's only through their own academic disciplines. And so like if the representative is some physical scientist, they build caucus with the physical sciences. They aren't their own separate tier 3, tier 4 group. So right now, it's just kind of a box. It's sort of attached-ish. And then we also have all the different committees. That's what falls under my purview. That's where we talk about, like, the appropriations or advocacy or diversity international students or faculty awards or the finance or programming. So, and then under communications would be, like, the division chiefs, which report back to the voting members and the field reps and whatnot. So that's where we stand right now. That's the status quo. With the status quo comes a lot of issues. So one of the biggest ones is many fields don't send us reps. There's also many field reps who come, but just kind of come for free food and either don't want to participate or feel like they can't participate for whatever reason. And what's happened is we have had decreased participation in committees and in the work they have through the GPSA. And what that leads to is a GPSA that is not as functional and not representing our interests, which is not what anybody wants. So to kind of elaborate on some of these issues, some fields don't even know we exist, despite numerous contact efforts. Some fields don't have a field organization, or it's like loosely defined, and therefore they don't have a way to get the field funding. Some fields choose not to send us a representative, which is well within their right. And then some field reps feel it's a waste of time if they can't vote. Some don't have the time to care or to fully invest in GPSA. Some would like to know more but feel intimidated by all of these motions and resolutions and parliamentary jargon. Or feel like people will make fun of them if they say something that's wrong. This is a thing that happens. And many members, this isn't the only thing they do. They're also in other advocacy groups on campus. So some people are increasingly skeptical of our ability to advocate on behalf of students and feel other avenues are a more effective means of doing so. And it's often what happens is a lot of the work that happens, it's not shown on the floor. It happens behind the scenes in meetings with administrators or with other groups on campus. And what happens is, when there's less buy-in, we get less people that want to be on committees, and then more and more is done by fewer and fewer people. Sorry. And then it's just not sustainable, ultimately. And, of course, the demographics of GPSA are not necessarily the demographics of the student body average. You'll notice that the international population in particular is drastically underrepresented by the people that are in this room. And that could be for a number of reasons. It could be because the individual fields aren't sending a diverse cast of people to us. It could also mean we're not reaching out well enough. It could be they are choosing to go in other avenues for advocacy. There's a whole bunch of reasons why that might be happening. So what do we do? So in that packet, I have a bunch of different ideas that have been bandied about. Some are more feasible or more radical than others, but we are all ears and would like some feedback. So some of these things could be giving field reps full voting rights so that they vote on resolutions. Some could be requiring the voting members take on leadership roles in the assembly to help disperse the workload. Some could be creating like a new division for these tier 3 or 4 organizations. It could be a bigger executive committee. It could be scaling back what we're doing in GPSA, so we're really focusing on things we have the time to focus on. It could be giving the option for field reps to go to committees instead of general assemblies. Anything's on the table right now. So we're going to break up into our division breakouts. And the idea is we're going to see, are these things that resonate with you? Are these issues that you've encountered? Which ideas sound good? Which ideas maybe not so good? What should GPSA look like in the future? So at this point, with that said, I'm going to leave this slide up here for some ideas. We're going to break up into division breakouts.
I can take like a few clarification questions before we break out, but all the discussions should happen in division breakouts.
And then we'll come back and meet as a whole group to share what we have.
So I had met.
A whole group.
Okay. So where should they sit for a division breakout?
Okay, let's do same old. So let's do social sciences over here. Let's do biological sciences over here. Humanities over here. Physical sciences in the back. And professional schools, people come down and for me. And 2, 3, 4, go to your division that messes with you.
It's so heavily weighted for addressing. Part of it is a law school is here. The law school being is here for funding. I mean, there are people care, but the law school and the business school and operating silos. That being said, part of it also is, in terms of the percentage of population, we're a third of the population, we're about 15% of the voting membership. So it's about half of what paper is okay. What would be roughly half of what you
And I don't think it's really true anymore.
That students will never hear about it, and even if we email them about it, it's never pursued. I think most of the issue is in the vet school, where we don't go outside to find opportunities in the greater community, in the graduate community. I don't know exactly what the GPSA can do.
So can I make a complaint that I wanted to talk about, specifically this idea of not playing
body, people in the general body, which is oftentimes not meeting to like what's going on in their respective school or home directly influence things that are like related to
you.
She wants so I can make it work. So I guess my question for you is, like, what is the question you're asking? The question that, like, do you actually think that it's meaningful to be in the double body, or would you prefer instead to be attending your meeting? So you pick a committee that you're interested in, that makes you feel interested in, and you attend that committee.
I think hearing about what's going on with graduate students and other professionals is valuable. It's some of it I can bring back to the prep school, and I know other schools that have brought back. I don't know if sitting on an individual specialized committee would be helpful.
I think there's a silo aspect of the same law program. It really is. But what the undergrads do is they send a newsletter out to everyone every month or whatever it is. And I know I've been told even they could do that, but even if you wanted to get out, they're going to give target conditions to you and say, okay, here is what's going on with X. Because a lot of it is, I mean, even you saw the presentation, it's not a dissertation writing, which is, I mean, it's important. But you know, when you have 30 population that's not, for better or worse, not ready to speak. So it's, I mean, the body is full of angled towards it. You should make it for the membership and because they have no one to engage.
Yes.
And it creates a vicious cycle.
Regarding the newsletter, it depends on now. It's a responsibility of without the meetings, don't usually go on for longer than an hour. Some committees that like have a lot of their meetings that can go longer, so you just feel like they're really active this semester. So sometimes they have meetings that go on for like an hour and a half. Oh, sorry. This stands for Diversity and Interactive Communications. So those are our standing. We have the information committee, so they deal with how we spend the graduate process student activity, finance committee, which deals with how we allocate money to student organizations, student advocacy committee, the diversity and interactive student committee, programming, which plans events on campus. Thank you. Faculty awards, and then the three that are sort of like the exact committee, the operations staffing. So those are the nine that we have right now. We don't have one that's like specifically for the board. I actually think that's a really great idea. I have these two committees. We have a really large variety of external committees. So you could sit on the advisory committee, you could sit on the, I think, the presidential task force for sexual violence. There's like a lot of external committees, and I think that we probably have maybe about 30% of our external committees. That's not like a lot of. So, for a lot of like the most powerful stuff I can do, is get your own independent, and they're able to tell, like, this is the problem, and they're like, I had no idea. Because lots of times they're willing to work for them, but they just don't know, and they really forget about, like,
you said one thing that maybe one improvement that the PPSA can make to this is like acronyms, right? The field reps and the school. And like there are acronyms that are used all the time that I'm not familiar with. And like sometimes things are referenced like to previous years. They go to undergrad here. To previous years, and I don't know what they are, and like they go by too quickly. There's not even time for me to ask what they are. So if there were like a guidebook or like a glossary maybe I'll do it.
Here's what I can possibly, and I actually asked him, everyone, we have a viewing of a Robert Field cheat sheet. I think that's just basically how emotions work, how, like, if you're brand new, how does the process work? We can staple on that, brief watch of what the acronyms are doing.
Yeah, so we did actually, yeah, we have a box. I think this year we did give, like, a cheat sheet that always comes out of, like, a formal meeting, and I know that the professional schools sometimes operate that in the management term, so sometimes they don't give those ones. We've also talked about in the past, do you know what the two ways that talking about, like, putting it on the back of our class, so you can really, like, flip over your model and create the acronym and the proper stuff and stuff. But yeah, I do think that's important. That is the only thing.
About 100 divisions. There's no description. I mean, I've been involved in that as an undergraduate, so I know. I didn't really have either. I've never heard of that committee. So even having, and it's a bit of an undertaking, but even have a list of, maybe even perhaps color, like, okay, we're looking at a committee that looks at how does university regulate residence council and alcohol and other drugs. That might appeal more to a law student. Not that it wasn't clear, but almost flags, it's almost a big list, and flags, and okay, have some lofty stuff, but these on paper sound like things that might be interesting. Obviously, there's no, you want to raise your lofty things more than that, but almost instead of going through, like, faculty music committee, not necessarily something that I'm not seeing you might be, but it's just to try and help cut through the fact that we've got like 500 things to say.
No, I just think, like, making the position seem more, like, they're really important positions, people know that, so I think you have to, like, go on to the meetings and advocate and send out, like, if you have the new position person, things so, like, have people go and say, hey, you would be in charge of student advocacy for the whole graduate sexual community. Like, people in the law school definitely don't understand the scope of, like, what being a co-chair of that means. So somehow, like, more important than, like, Robert's rules and the session is just, like, recruiting the right people and, like, new faces, people who are, like, powerhouse leaders in their communities, like, getting them to come and run for positions here. They think, like, everyone turns out, like, in the business because they've been doing it for so long.
I think we have to move back to our agenda. Some important or interesting talking points from each division. Let's start with professional school.
Yeah, I'll go first. So something that came up that I actually thought was really interesting is we're considering is specifically creating a standing committee for the professional schools, specifically focused on advocacy within those schools. A lot of what we do is very grad focused, and so it might be really valuable for us to actually create a committee. Also, creating a guidebook for new representatives. While we knew sooner than the introduction at the first meeting of the year, professional school students tend to have January and January terms, and so they often miss that introduction. So having something that is longer lasting for them to use might be better.
Social sciences. So a brief summary of what we talked about was that like this kind of general outreach technique, so using reaching out to certain field organizations, so the field organizations know about the GPSA. Also perhaps some kind of orientation at the beginning for new field reps. We talked about having that so they know kind of how the GPSA works, and also how voting works. And then into consulting, and we talked about doing division breakouts to go on each issue. And one thing that I just talked about at the very end was how field reps participating in committees, how that can count for the GPSA participation. So I'll just say, committee to come from some
Okay, thank you. Life sciences?
So I've written down three things. It seems like the group generally liked the idea of having maybe the second meeting of each semester in a year. Instead of doing a division breakout, you do sort of like a GPSA committee meet. So that would be a chance for all the existing members of the committee and the chair to be present, and you could come and talk with them and ask them questions, because the alternative is emailing folks and it's a little awkward and there's some tension there. There was a member of the division who voiced wanting to have voting membership for
the Indigenous Graduate Students
Association. Thank you. And so we talked a little bit about that. Didn't necessarily come to a conclusion. And then one of our members also said that maybe first we need to define what we want the GPSA to be doing before we talk about how to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Arts and humanities.
So a couple of things that I'd like to hear. So a couple of things we talked about. Field reps express actually difficulty performing a central function of field reps, so the entire idea of reporting back to and getting feedback from fields at large, when fields at large don't necessarily meet regularly. And the idea of sending an email to a department listserv and not getting feedback back doesn't seem like an actual genuine engagement with the field. So on one hand, like, the actual job of field reps seems to be one that could use some rethinking. There was very strong thoughts in our small division about opening up voting for everyone. Just more voting, more people can vote. That came back to one of the stronger problems that we were talking about, which was the problem of apathy, the problem of people just not caring about the GPSA, not wanting to come to us in the first place. And field reps in particular expressed that voting, that having everybody be able to vote, would increase a feeling of having stakes in meetings. And that would start to get at the seemingly unsolvable problem of apathy. We didn't get to talk about Tier 3 and Tier 4 stuff, which I wish we did. So we did. Am I missing anything?
Okay. Thank you.
We actually, a couple of people raised the idea that shrinking the scope of the GPSA might be a good idea. We did not get into how that would happen or what that would look like, but what kind of very difficult decisions that would have to be made. But that was raised as like, okay, that might be a good idea.
That was also raised in biological sciences.
Okay.
So our group seemed to have a pretty good consensus that expanding voting rights would make a lot of sense to address these issues. In terms of quorum, there's an interesting idea that we could have some sort of subset of members, and as long as a certain percentage of those members are present, then that counts as quorum, and then everyone who's in the room is a rep against the votes. And as opposed to like having to worry about. So like maybe like there's 20 people, and as long as like 15 of them, 10 to 15 are there, then like the 80 people get a vote. And then there was some interesting discussion about like, and when it came to Tier 3, 4 organizations, like, should their voting be dependent on having the same rep show up every time or not? And whereas if you had some sort of rotating system, then you could get more voices in the room at different times. And I don't know, were there any other times? I can't remember. I was... Sorry. So there was some interest in possibly reducing the scope. What would that look like? Who knows at this point? That's another conversation that probably needs to be had, though.
Okay. So thank you so much for your input. I guess we'll revisit a lot of these issues again in the upcoming meetings. And for now, yes, Tyler.
I think the entire biological sciences division, thought that 10 minutes was not nearly enough time to have a meaningful conversation about this. So in what you're saying, we'll touch back at this, are you in the intention to have more conversations during the big breakouts, or to dedicate here a block of time within an assembly meeting to talk about it, or are you still thinking of what that could look like?
So we're just thinking about what that could look like. We'd like to be able to do more division breakouts, which is like a really valuable way to spend that time. Ops is also going to be looking at that, so if there are people in the room who like have gotten excited about this conversation or interested, like please talk to Alex and like attend the Ops meetings, because that's where like a lot of this conversation was generated last semester, and where a lot of this conversation has been discussed again, because as they consider actual bylaw changes, that's Ops' responsibility.
So next on the agenda, we have comments and updates. First up is exec.
No updates.
Operations.
Can you postpone mine till the end?
Okay. Communications.
No updates.
Appropriations.
We have a meeting this Friday at 6 p.m. Morrison Hall, room 122, I believe, if you want to come.
Okay. And then for finance, Beth had to leave. She has no updates, but they have their February budget review meeting right now. That's what she has to know. Student advocacy.
I have an announcement on behalf of Bree. She says, join us for our next SAC meeting next Monday, March 5th at 2 p.m. Inferno G01. We will be continuing to tackle the issues raised at the town hall and other platforms such as mental health, transportation, and student disability services. If anyone has questions, reach out to the co-chairs, Brianna or Nicholas. And then Brianna's ID is BMK76.
Mm-hmm. BMK76. Okay. Thank you. Disc?
So, Disc is working on a couple of initiatives currently. One that we're starting to investigate and do preliminary research on is international student language proficiency requirements. And both related to TA-ship and related to students' requirements when they have graduated from an English-speaking institution, how we might look into those things, issues that students have been having related to them. The second is working with Student Disability Services to address several accessibility concerns that were brought up at the town hall a few weeks back. And then ongoing outreach and engagement activities. If you're interested in working with the Diversity International Students Committee, please contact me, Eugene. My net ID is EPL49.
Thank you. Any comments or questions for Eugene? Programming. Shianne is not here today, so faculty awards.
Neither Xander nor Ajay are here yet.
Okay. General comment?
No.
Okay. And I don't think the consensual relationship task force. They're coming to our next meeting?
Yes.
And the grad school?
So you may have noticed every other week in the Monday grad announcements there are tactics. We're working with a graduate student. I don't know if he's here. Who's helping us identify the most needed information to share with graduate students. So if you have suggestions or ideas or needs in that area, you could email me, jan.allen@cornell.edu. And Eugene, the graduate school has a task force going this semester, looking at English language proficiency for international students. We had our second meeting of the semester today with the recommendations to the team for necessary changes. And I would love to have input of students. Don't write down and say duh. But yes, we would love to have student input on what you think the issues are. We're looking primarily at TOEFL and IELTS for admission, and then the resources, support, and other things that are needed for international students prior to TA.
Which is
that one exactly for those of us?
Okay. Any comments or questions for Jen?
Alicia, motion to amend the agenda such that open forum follows right after. Just because I think we're going to run over and you want to give folks an opportunity because I know we have people.
I have a question regarding the central relationship. I don't know if the information that task force are here. I'm just curious, what is the task force
doing next?
We're talking about my own.
Second that one.
So there's a motion now to move open forum to before the new business. We have people here who would like to talk for a few minutes. Any dissent?
Oh, can I give my update real quick?
No. Any dissent to moving open forum before new business?
Oh, I see.
Seeing none. We'll have you before new business. And before that, Alex, you wanted to give your update?
Yeah, so we are going to continue this conversation in ops. We will be meeting at 1:30 on Friday. I need to find a room, but we'll be an email going out very shortly. And if all welcome to attend that meeting to continue the conversation about the structure. And we will post a follow-up with what happened in that meeting at the next meeting.
Tyler.
3 and 7 email to?
Everyone.
All members?
Yeah.
And I saw the co-chair of the Consensual Relationship Task Force just come in. Did you want to make an update about the Consensual Relationship Task Force?
Not today, thank you, but we will be here shortly.
Okay, yes. But Matt, you had a question.
I'm curious, what is the kind of a meeting?
I believe we are meeting this Friday, is it? I have on my calendar. Thursday, 3 p.m., Day Hall 305.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So now we have Chris, who's here for the open forum.
Yeah. Hey guys, I'm Chris.
Hi guys, I'm Dean.
Hi guys, I'm Anika.
And we're part of the EdgeBox team. We are a student-run peer-to-peer storage service, currently members of the eLab Startup Accelerator Program, and we're looking to revolutionize on-campus storage options this summer. So right now, we identify two big problems with storage. On the one hand, current storage options are very expensive. Oftentimes, students are actually paying more for storage than they are for items that are actually in the boxes. This really puts a huge burden, especially on low-income students who have to pay hundreds of dollars to store their items over the summer. On the other hand, we have a lot of space on campus and also in the community that is unused over the summer. That's just laying vacant that people are actually still paying rent or leases for. EdgeBox seeks to target both these problems at once. On the one hand, our storage services are around 40-50% cheaper than current computing services on campus. And on the other hand, we allow people with surplus space over the summer to monetize that and earn hundreds of dollars over the summer, basically just like keeping stuff in their space that they're not living in, where they have surplus space over the summer. So we thought that particularly for graduate students who either are on campus on the summer or have space over the summer that they're not using, could make hundreds of dollars by storing some boxes there and helping their community really save a lot of money. Exactly. So the way this would work is we have an online platform, pretty much like Airbnb, where you sign up, you create a listing, putting down your price points and how much you're going to charge per box, and creating a profile, maybe your location, whether you want to offer transportation to potential renters. And then once your listing's on the website, you connect with renters just like people do on Airbnb. And then they would bring their boxes over to store, or you help them transport them over to your place. And then at the end of the summer, once the successful like storage has been successfully completed, you'd receive your payment. So in terms of money you could earn, we have some figures here. So if you store like 15 boxes and get $330 based on our current price model, you have some flexibility to adjust your own price and how much you want to charge. We'd probably put down a cap just for the initial summer because we want to really penetrate the market here, but you have some flexibility in how to do that. This is some of what you would expect. Yeah, and then I think more like beyond like bringing money for yourself and really helping the community here, I think particularly low-income students for whom storage is a large burden, but making connections within the community and really helping build community with other members of the Cornell campus. We've actually had limited trial runs over the past summer, not as much of a concerted effort as we're pursuing this year, but we actually have graduate students use our service, and this is a testimonial from one
grad student who used this last summer, who was able to gain some financial benefit from that. So I guess that's that.
So we're currently rebranding and restructuring all the platforms, the website, the branding, and we plan to launch in early April, late March. And right now we're just trying to gain some interest from potential hosts like graduate students who could monetize and unlock the potential out there on the space.
Does anybody have any questions? Any questions or comments?
Jesse? Sorry, I might have missed it. I know you said how much folks who would have would close the boxes get paid. How much does it cost?
So exactly that much. So probably 10% more, but probably exactly that much.
Yeah,
so our platform doesn't take up as much from this, and it's purely like a peer-to-peer service. So what they pay you is what you get.
This is more of a question for the graduate school, but my previous institution, storage in the summer was heavily subsidized by the school, if not heavily paid for the design. Does the graduate school do things to offer storage for summer students? Have storage for summer students?
I stored a car, I can give you reference. It was in my driveway also.
Okay. I don't know about the graduate school, but this problem is faced by undergraduates, and storage is not subsidized by Cornell. In fact, their biggest they endorse Big Red Shipping, whose prices are substantially higher than this, makes it very difficult for students to figure out where to store their things over the summer.
So one last question.
So just kind of a practicality thing here. Say I'm going to be using the service, and I put something in that box, and I get my box returned to me, and it's not in there. What sort of process does somebody have to go through? And also, what sort of protection does that person who's holding onto that box, if that item was never in there, how are they protected?
Yeah, so in terms of graduate students, if you're going to be the host, you're going to be signing a contract. Both the parties will be signing a contract, and only if there's some sort of gross negligence would you be penalized. But if a house burns down, there's a flood, something that could not have been prevented by you as an individual, none of that responsibility would come upon you.
Okay, so do both parties know what is in each of the containers then?
No. Yeah, but what's in the container is the responsibility of the person who's trying to make the process. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much.
I think we can forward this to you, and we'll probably send out a Google form, and anyone who's interested can fill that out and send it out to the respective communities. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, we really appreciate it if you guys sort of send it out to any graduate students who you would benefit from this process. Okay.
Thank you.
So now we'll move on to
it's
a little bit warm. Oh yes. Okay. Did you want to say something?
Yeah.
Okay.
I saved this for open forum at the end of the assembly today, but I guess open forum now. And my comment comes on the back of a member of our assembly being disappointed and frustrated with with the resolution 10 and the review of the resolution that have toward the exec committee. And my conversation with other members of the committee, including the exec, who've been under a fair amount of duress and stress this semester. I have this written down so I don't waste too much of your time. I'm going to stick to my points. For the purpose of my comment today, I want to introduce myself to you as a sixth-year graduate student who's been involved in student advocacy since my second year in Cornell for the last 5 years. I'm sure you agree with me in that grad school in itself is grueling. There is almost always more papers to read, more experiments to do, more challenges to meet, and time is always our limiting commodity. And time to do work, time to care for ourselves, and God forbid for us to take a moment to breathe and just relax. At the back of this, despite all of this, I really do appreciate that everybody in this assembly is here today, investing their most valuable commodity, which is time to be here. And what's more is that we don't do this for fame, for monetary remunerations, for employment opportunity. We're all here today, we all put in a lot of effort, time, and passion towards what we do, because we want to help our peers, and because we want to make our combined experience here in grad school positive and constructive. But this is a rather thankless job. How many of you have had somebody stop by your desk and say, hey, thanks for being involved in student activism? That hasn't happened in my 5 years here. So I invite you to take, and this is even harder given all the work that you do beyond being here in the various committees. It's incredibly hard for me on the exec. I would never stand to be on the exec because I admit I don't have the time or the wherewithal to cope with the number of meetings and agenda items that they have on it. So, my rambling comes to an end where I invite you to take a moment to join me in appreciating, applauding, and celebrating all of our efforts to make Cornell a better place for all.
Thank you, Aaron. Any other items? Yes.
Hi guys, I'm Dara, I'm a grad student trustee, and I'm looking to recruit GRS and TAs for a trustee reception in March. The June and dates are the 23rd and 24th, and we're hoping to shine light on the supporting role that GRS and TAs have to play. It really lies outside of their job description, so especially with the national campus climate issues, essentially shining light on the relationships that GRS and TAs have with their students and how they have to take on these roles of uplifting students during these times, and hoping for some positive reinforcement either monetary-wise or just support encouragement-wise from the board. If you're interested in attending the reception, just email me. My net ID is DPB73. Thanks.
DPB73. Okay, so in the interest of time, we really do have to move on to our new business for the day. And first we have Resolution 10, condemning the violation of the autonomy of the GPSA. Jesse?
Motion to not read, right? I'm not going to read it. Hopefully, I know it went out yesterday, so you had a chance to read it. Basically, this resolution is just kind of coming on the tail of the last couple weeks in this body, and then the way in which what was those kinds of meetings where we were talking about things, where those of us who were division chiefs stood up here and we were talking about stuff that we couldn't talk about, and then there was some email exchange on a listserv that those of the voting members are on, and then we were informed that a member of our assembly was removed from a UA committee by the UA exec committee. The way that these kinds of things happened in a way that wasn't transparent to everyone in the body, and this is just kind of an expression of a grievance with the way in which the UA was able to or has the ability to revoke a GPSA appointed member to a UA committee themselves in a way that seems to some of us infringe on the kind of autonomy of the GPSA when, and I don't want to read but because it's already there, I'm repeating what it says already, but when the UA is made up of constituent bodies, right? And that action where the UA can remove this kind of appointed by us member makes it feel like instead of us being like making up a body, it makes it feel like this. Like there's the kind of authority, and then you know, we're the students being told that you don't really know what you're doing, you made a bad decision, so we're gonna make the decision for you. And that seems like something that seems out of whack to at least me, because my name's on it, right? So this is just kind of reflecting that. I also would add that mechanism by which GPSA appointed member of the UA committee was removed, was added or created or crafted within the past year, so it's a new kind of movement, which, you know, voting members we just talked about today are the most informed members of the GPSA, and I wasn't aware when it was kind of invoked as a, or not invoked, but created as a policy that it could be done. So that's just something that we should be thinking about, is how shared governance bodies, which are different from each other and yet co-constitutive of each other, have policies that can, or mechanisms by which they can influence each other's committees and how we want to go about this. So this is kind of just expressing that sentiment that, hey, we feel like we were being like treated like kind of, you know, the students who another authority figure has to come in and say, this is now what you're going to do. And that doesn't seem like in the spirit of coequal shared governance. So that's the spirit of the resolution and what it's really trying to get at. So with that, questions, right?
So, yeah, we open the meeting to question and answer. Any snack?
Yeah, so thank you. I'm still a little confused. When we talked about it a couple meetings ago, when there was a message brought by the election, I'm still confused exactly what happened. I mean, in essence, like, this resolution, I read it yesterday when I got it, and I was just curious what exactly has happened. Because, in essence, you're asking us, it seems, to, I'm not understanding it correctly, to condemn an action, but I don't understand what the action was, why it was taken, more or less. Like, what exactly is going on, and what are you asking us to condemn? Like, this is like, the answer is confidentiality. I don't really, I don't know what's going on that would cause us to do this unless I know what happened.
So I can answer that question mechanically. So the TPSA appointed an individual to a UA, a University Assembly Committee. The University Assembly has the power in its, I want to say charter and bylaws, but is that correct? Is it the charter and bylaws that does it?
You can say charter and bylaws.
Yeah, okay, charter and bylaws to revoke the membership of a member of one of its committees that was appointed by another body, one of its constituent bodies. So the fact that the GPSA, for example, would appoint that member and then the UA can then de-appoint that member seems like what's being condemned there would be the action of the UA exec coming in and making a decision about an appointment that the GPSA made, where it seems that the GPSA is making an autonomous decision and that it's being kind of vetoed, if you will, when that's part of the UA's governing documents, but not part of ours.
To clarify, two things. One, what do our governing documents say about external committee removal? And two, I know you mentioned that this procedure appears to be new-ish, and I don't think I pulled an old version of the UA's charter from prior to 2015, and the provision says the UA executive committee can remove members, so it's clearly, I mean, that's the charter dated 2015, so it's more than a year old, so I mean, I'm curious where that information came from, and also the first part as well.
Sorry. That came from conversations with folks in the UA.
So what did the GPSA say? What are our documents say about moving
external committees? Oh, sorry, for our stuff, we have, the next resolution we'll talk about this, but we have not a lot, we don't have a lot of substance in our government documents about what do we do when we want to remove someone. We can do things like go to someone and ask them to remove themselves, and we can do things like say, you might want to think about removing yourself, or maybe we can have this, or we can bring a conversation to the floor. We can kind of have these feel it out conversations with folks, but we have little concrete policy about it.
Any other comments, questions? Yes.
So, based on this principle, what's to stop a university assembly committee from perpetually preventing the participation of the GPSA or any constituent assembly by continually removing elected members? Appointed members to those committees. Is there some restriction that is imposed by Lightning, or is it just arbitrary?
You're asking if, like, right now, they remove someone and someone else is put on, they can just remove that.
Right. So
okay.
Can they just keep doing that? Like,
it's my understanding, as far as my understanding of reading the documents, yes, they could do that if they wanted. Kind of like, I would trust they wouldn't, but yeah, they could.
What information is there anyone from the UA executive committee in the room to talk about this?
There are a few people.
Okay. Could we defer some of these questions and then so we
yeah.
can get an answer?
So can we defer the answer to
am I right? If I'm not right,
okay.
Thinking that's possible.
Do you wanna address that in detail? Introduce yourself, yeah?
Alright, hi everybody. I'm Gabe, I'm the chair of the UA and I'm an undergraduate, so I'm the undergraduate representative on the UA executive committee. I saw this resolution yesterday, and I thought it would probably behoove me to attend this meeting. wish that, like, someone had contacted me before condemning the procedure, because, like, we're very okay with changing our procedures. Last year, we actually changed our charter to add 2 seats for grad students, and we didn't need a resolution to condemn the UA for having fewer grad students. So I would prefer that we kind of, like, have a healthy dialogue and say, like, you know, we feel that this is violating our autonomy, because we're very okay discussing procedures, but this seems like it's been anticipated by a specific incident, and I would prefer to, you know, talk about how we can have good process.
Anna?
It is my understanding that this particular procedure was set in motion, the Office of the Assembly is against it. I could be wrong there.
So, Bob, did you want to answer that? Because Bob is another UA exec member.
Well, I was a member of the ranking faculty member on the University of Southern Executive Committee. I agree with what Dave has said, that we're open to think of ways to do this better. The action we took was not one that we took lightly. We spent 2.5 months very carefully considering our options, looking at what other options were available. It was not an easy decision to make. I mean, we talked about it because there were high degrees of confidentiality. I don't think that the options open to us were by any means perfect. I think we should all explore better ways forward. But it was a unanimous decision by those on the executive committee, and I think we made the right decision, and I hope you would respect it.
So we have
Jordan. This is still Q&A, right?
Sorry?
This is still Q&A, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So my question would be, if the proposal is that the GPSA have some other means of coming to the UA with the complaint, what would you suggest? This is our method for making decisions in the body. And so the way the GPSA decides to make a complaint is to vote on it.
We have Margaret.
This whole situation has seemed ludicrous to me since the beginning, since the very first time this was brought up. I don't care what happened, I don't know what happened, but I think it all goes back to how this was dealt with in this body. I'm not condemning anyone in particular. I'm not detracting from the job done by volunteers here. I understand that it's hard work. But if this process was being reviewed by UA, and we were not told that as GPSA members when this was brought up before us, I think it was 1 meeting ago now, I don't remember, that's something we should have known. If this was something that you guys have been looking at, we should have known that, and I'm pissed that we didn't.
So should we? I'm listening and I'm saying, should we move to discussion?
Yeah.
This sounds like discussion to me, too.
So there's been a motion to move to formal discussion.
Okay.
Any dissent to moving to discussion? Seeing none, we'll be moving to formal discussion. Next, I have Joe.
Hi, everyone. My name is Joe. I'm an undergrad. I chair one of the UA committees. I chair the Camp 12 committee specifically. In my honest opinion, I think, truthfully, this is a conversation that can be solved through dialogue. Resolutions imply actions. Resolutions get sent to the president of the university. This is a conversation that the UA and GPSA can sit down and work out. This is not a massively new, radical idea in which two assemblies sit down and have a conversation together. In fact, the GPSA and the FA did it earlier this year. I think, honestly, this is childish. That's my opinion, and I'm a sophomore undergrad. You can sit down and have a conversation, but it ultimately just needs to have a conversation. This is why people hate the assemblies. This is why people hate politics, because it's drama. Sit down, do some work, and let's actually change this campus. I'm done. I see it all the time from undergrads, I see it all the time from grads, and I don't care what you, I mean, maybe I'm naive, maybe I'm young, maybe I'm not a grad. Those are all correct. I am young. Not one yet. But have conversations. really do what it's harder to do. Because honestly, this is just, it's ridiculous.
Thank you.
Can I respond to that really quickly? This is my 6th year in graduate school. I've been doing the work for 6 years. I get the performance, the fact that part of politics performance is shitty. But the charge that, like, this is coming from a place where, as if it's substituting for doing the work. I mean, everything else like here, but it's like the idea that this is substituting for doing the work after doing 6 years of work is, yeah, I'm just going to, yeah, that's not
okay. I want you to know that
yeah.
6 years of
work. Okay. We have Eugene next. Eugene, next.
Yeah, I just want to touch on a few points that have been mentioned, I guess. One of which is that a resolution is the way that we make a statement. I don't know if that's necessarily true. It's good for one certain type of statement. We can make motions that are not resolutions if the body decides that it wants to investigate or address an issue in any way. So I would like the body to be well aware of that fact as we go forward in this conversation. But I do tend to agree that maybe, in my opinion, promulgating the drama and issues that have already happened through sort of a incendiary resolution at this point is probably not the most healthy way for the assemblies to move forward.
Okay. We have Dave.
My comment on the road.
Carlos.
I can just make a comment and kind of agree with some of the things that have already been said, that I'm a little bit confused about this resolution and what it's trying to do. It doesn't seem to be actually like doing anything, it's just condemnation, and I don't really understand the point of that. And the other thing is, I believe that parts of this matter are confidential, and I think that, like, because of the confidentiality of some of the personal matters in this, people in the assembly are not fully informed to even be able to express a fully informed opinion on this resolution.
I had that.
Thank you. I read this, and there's some points in here, again, that may or may not, that may be slightly contradictory. I mean, if assemblies are co-equal and independently sovereign, and if every assembly that I've heard and I've read says each assembly has control over its committees, it would make sense that the UN can remove their members from their own committees. I mean, I was chair of the UA for a couple years, and our bylaws dictate the committee allocation is relatively equal. But my question is here, and I still haven't got an answer. In gather that someone was removed. I still don't know who. I don't know why. In essence, like, to me, it's like if someone went out and frankly murdered someone, I wouldn't expect that to be resolved. I would actually be hitting it. Like, what happened here that took this action? I mean, I actually went back and looked back. I found UHR 2011. This provision to remove members who, I believe the provision is, whose absence or behavior disrupts the sound operation of the committee. Well, clearly, the UA exec, which I remember a couple years ago, when I was on, we were deliberate, we thought things through. Like, what caused them in their opinion to say, okay, some action taken by someone, again, I don't know who, which makes it kind of, it's weird to talk about this ethereal person, but, like, what was the rationale? Like, I mean, I remember the GPC brought it up, there's been some, like, people were talking about it, I've asked people and said, oh, I can't tell you, like, what is going on here? If you want us to condemn an action, well, like, okay, the action was taken, but why was it taken? I want an answer to that because I don't feel comfortable censoring someone and saying, oh, you did this, okay, great. But to me, it's not what you did, it's why you did it. And I just can't see a good answer to that. I haven't got it.
Okay, so Jesse was next.
I wanted to speak to, like, the way in which this resolution, like, what is this resolution trying to do? What do resolutions do? What are the functions of resolutions? And what precipitates this resolution. So in my 6 years in the assembly, one of the drums that I've been beating for a very long time is that a lot of the functions of what we do and a lot of the conversations that we have is not a real big we. It's a very small we. It's a couple people who meet in a room on campus somewhere or go to the bar and have a beer together, and decisions get made about who should meet with which administrators about what. Decisions get made about who should we tap to be in the chair of what committee when. A lot of decisions, a lot of discussions happen in the GPSA and Eastern Government in general. And now I'm not even, this is kind of me talking more than just the obvious incident that we just can't talk enough about. I think you're right, we can't talk enough about it, and I wish we could talk more about it, and it's a pain in the ass. But this is the way in which this resolution and this moment is precipitated by the kind of what I was mentioning, the years that I've spent here, where a lot of what happens in this assembly, and not just this assembly, is a small number of people having non-public conversations in spaces that are not this floor about who should be going where and doing what. And so part of this resolution, it, for me at least personally, whether we want to pass this language or not pass this language, is about actually, you know, having people on the floor talk about what the hell is going on and how we can have these conversations here that are tense, rather than a small number of people having conversations like this over at the bar at the BRB afterwards.
Point of information, what procedures did the University Executive Committee follow? What was their rationale for taking this action? And I think Jesse said it great, like, we get to hear, can we hear what they hear, what the rationale was, much they can share. Point of information for that through this statement.
I think it's been said a couple of times that to protect the privacy of the individuals who have been affected by, you know, the patterns of behavior that we saw, we feel kind of uncomfortable commenting about that in a public setting. I would only feel comfortable talking about the specific situation if the affected individual or individuals that, but I don't it's clear that hasn't happened. So I just feel it's pretty we don't want to embarrass anybody, and that's the reason why we didn't consult everybody, because no one deserves that, even if they do something wrong. But if we could have been more transparent, you know, we have in the past we removed someone, we were as transparent as possible about that. But this, you know, this was really to protect the individuals involved.
I have Aaron.
My comments are specific to the three resolve clauses. Clearly, it seems obvious that there needs to be that we need to revisit the UA's process that was followed here, and I'm glad and appreciate that you're here today and that you're open to that discussion. Given that they are open to the discussion and that we have past members here that are willing to have that discussion, I think that's resolved, and we can see what process they come up with together to see if it resolves the concern. But I do want to shed light on the third resolve clause. As an assembly, we're as strong as all of us are together, and I don't like that last resolve clause because it kind of points a finger at the executive committee and says, you didn't do this. Heaven knows that I've been with the executive committee on numerous occasions, both this exec and the previous exec, and I've always made it a point to have a conversation, to reach out to them and say, hey, this doesn't work, this is wrong, and if it's important to me, then yes, I would have a resolution against it, or a rally force against it. But I don't know if this conversation has happened, that the exec willfully did not act upon this, that is calling for a resolution to condemn their action, versus if they tried their best, that was the best solution they came to. And therefore, I am strongly against pointing the finger against one of our own members to say they didn't act on a concern, despite the fact it seems like they tried their best.
Motion to extend the meeting by 5 minutes for when at the end of the meeting.
Is there a second? Sorry, any dissent? Missing none, we're extending the meeting by 5 minutes.
Motion to table this resolution. We have other resolutions in the agenda that are ready to get to them, and we're adding 5 minutes, but motion to table this.
Second.
Motion to table.
How long?
Actually, look. It seems like we have a voucher here discussion, so motion to table is indefinitely. We take it off the table after we talk to the UN.
Okay, so there's a motion to table
indefinitely.
Yes,
and then we'll talk to the UA and we'll figure out what we want to do. I'm still horribly confused, and I think a lot of members are.
Okay, so there's been a motion to table indefinitely. Is there a second? Okay, so now we have to vote on tabling this indefinitely. Voting members, so tabling indefinitely means that we are tabling this and we're going to have a vote to pull it back on to the agenda? Yes. Okay. So there's been a motion to table this indefinitely. Voting members in favor of tabling this indefinitely, please raise your preference. Oh, yeah. Those opposed? Abstaining? So with a vote of 10-1-5, with the absences, the motion passes, so the resolution has been tabled indefinitely, and we'll be having a discussion with the UA on this matter. And next we have another resolution, tasking the GPSA ops and staffing with developing a procedure for disciplining members. Becca?
So I think first it's worth highlighting that we're right here, right now, beginning this conversation that I think we've identified really needs to happen. So I want to identify that as a positive piece of progress. If nothing else, the incident that Jesse just spoke to highlights the GPSA governing documents' sincere lack of standards or procedures for handling conduct issues among our membership. While this precedent is something we wish we didn't need, its absence has opened our assemblies to perception of unfairness and illegitimacy. Within the assemblies, myself and other voting members are very frustrated with how ad hoc process is used against one of our colleagues in the January 29th meeting. An incident that could have probably been addressed more efficiently in conversations over beer rather than over Robert's rules. This incident in question was not explained well to any voting members who were asked for permission to let the Operations and Staffing Committee create an arbitrary process for discipline. When we push back about the ambiguity, which we're identifying now, the cause was simply dropped from GPSA discussion via email and addressed independently and quietly by the UA. This is not the first time that our lack of disciplinary process has caused difficulties. For example, we very recently had a voting member asked to resign because of inappropriate sexual comments. I only found out about this because of rumor after the fact, which, as a voting member, I find unacceptable. What if this particular voting member had not agreed to resign when their resignation was requested? What procedures would we have needed to move forward with disciplining this member? I don't think any of our limited policies, which more thoroughly address unseating members because of their lack of participation, rather than because of behavior that does not represent our constituents, is satisfactory. I personally know of many people who are frustrated by these issues and how, at present, this lack of process has indirectly been used to undermine work being done to address the issue of hate speech in the code of conduct. We need to remember that this was an initiative requested at the request of our constituents who have since all but given up on shared governance. It's also important to reflect on our history of shared governance here at Cornell, which arose from student unrest on campus nearly 50 years ago. Because of the hard work and activism of many students before us, we are quite privileged to even have the little access that we do to participate in decisions about the university. Before returning to Cornell for graduate school, I started my program at an institution where the very idea of having the ear of the university president or the board of trustees was unthinkable. I happen to know of many members of the administration at many levels that think that this, what is currently happening in our assembly right now on the floor, is an embarrassment which has resulted from our lack of process. When President Pollack, who has expressed both her support and her increasing reservation for shared governance, potentially sees us as kids just playing government, we are potentially very quickly squandering what little voice we do have here. I hope this resolution can be a step towards taking our work and our constituents more seriously ourselves. So, regardless of all of this drama that's happened, I think it has highlighted some holes in our policies, and hopefully we can start to have a productive conversation about what to do in the future.
So, before moving to Q&A, I would like motion to extend a meeting by 5 minutes.
Second.
Okay. Any dissents? Okay, seeing none, the meeting is extended by 5 minutes, and we'll have like a Q&A now. Any questions or comments?
I guess as a comment, it might serve as a discussion point, I'm not sure. But I do believe that we have a standard for dealing with behavioral issues, and that's Robert's Rules of Order. And I know that in your explanation you said that people want to talk over beer and not Robert's Rules of Order, but we have Robert's Rules of Order for a reason. And whether those rules were followed in this instance, I don't believe they were. I would pay a whole lot of attention to all this going on. But I don't believe they were. I mean, Robert's Rules lays out that there's supposed to be an investigative committee, and then there needs to be a 2/3 vote of membership, and all those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been doing that. So I think that sort of if we want more specific thing than that, we can outline that in our standing rules or in our founding documents as we need to. But I think that the resolution as it's written is a little bit off base in that respect, because we do have a procedure. We perhaps did not use it appropriately, and perhaps it's not the appropriate procedure for what we want. But that's where we need to start from, rather than saying we don't have anything.
No, that's
fine. Can I clarify? So what I was saying wasn't that these conversations shouldn't be happening outside of the GPSA. What I was saying is that this particular incident, which we've been discussing, was a piece of drama that I think could have been discussed privately, and potentially we could have gotten a little bit further had we not relied on that structure. But then I think that when push came to shove, in several incidents that I highlight, albeit vaguely, but I've got to highlight, we haven't actually followed those rules we speak to that may actually exist.
So, first off, thank you. I was saying there's no process. I know explicitly, I think Jesse mentioned that for external clearance, we have no process. Like, that's something that we need to fix. And I thank you for this word, because I know Ops meeting this week, I was going to bring it up and say it. Again, I still am not really clear what happened. But either way, if it happened and it's super secret, double probation, whatever, it's good to have some form of least process where, okay, here's how you, at the very least, here's how you take action.
And I think that that's the fundamental outcome of this, is what happened, but now we need to realize that this is a hole in our policy, and whether we're starting from Robert's Rules or wherever we're starting from, it needs to be discussed.
Okay. So if there's no motion to move to discussion, we'll do the discussion.
Okay. So, the one is a little bit too, like, appear more serious with a document like this, and it's on the table of the president's office. Like, I feel like that's exactly the opposite. I feel like this is like, right now, to me, it sounds like, okay, there are like personal conflicts in the assembly and we're not able to solve them. And it sounds to me like it like sounds childish. If I would not know the GPSA, I would read up something like this, I would think, okay, there are people that don't get along, and I don't know if this is constructive. I don't know. So it's my opinion.
Sure. We can address that in formal discussion. But if there's still
the table is the remainder of our agenda and adjourn.
Okay.
Second.
There's been a second.
Sure.
Any dissent to tabling this, going into formal discussion in the next meeting and voting on that there, and adjourning right now. Okay, seeing none, we're now adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.